Potteries. Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Audrey.
And I'm Katie.
And today we are going to be talking all about the Marauder, the Defense Against the Dark Arts professor, and the kindest werewolf in literature, Remus Lupin. So before we get started with the actual episode today, we wanted to announce that when we get to 100 followers on our Instagram, which you can find at Wizard Studies Podcast, we will be doing a little bit of a giveaway for one of our listeners.
Yeah, so I picked up some goodies when I was in Universal, so I have some candy that we can give away. So we just really want to try and grow our Instagram a little bit, so it would really help us out if you gave us a follow, and we will reward you in return.
Yeah, and spread the word. Tell your friends to follow.
Yes, so Remus's full name is Remus John Lupin. He gets his name from the story in Roman mythology of Romulus and Remus, who are twin brothers. Romulus ends up killing Remus to become the founder of Rome. Romulus and Remus were both sons of Rhea Silva and the god Mars, who's the god of war, and they were abandoned on a hillside by King Amulius, because they were seen as a threat to his throne. And there are numerous versions of their story, and their survival, but one famous one includes the image of the twins being suckled by a she-wolf. So you can see, like, the obvious connections to wolf and that imagery in his first name. And then his last name can come from the word lupus, which in Latin means wolf. So basically, J.K. Rowling outs him as a werewolf from the first time we learn his name.
Yeah, everything but his middle name, which is just randomly John.
Yeah, solid name, average name.
Okay, so his birthday is March 10th, 1960, which happens to be 2 days after date of recording, March 8th.
Happy future birthday, or early birthday. So Lupin's wand is cypress and unicorn hair, 10 1/4 inches and pliable. So cypress wands are associated with nobility. The great medieval wand maker, Geraint Ollivander, who we can assume is related to our Ollivander, wrote that he was always honored to match a cypress wand, for he knew he was meeting a witcher wizard who would die a heroic death. Unfortunately, in these less bloodthirsty times, the possessors of cypress wands are rarely called upon to lay down their lives, though doubtless many of them would do so if required. Wands of cypress find their soulmates among the brave, the bold, and the self-sacrificing, those who are unafraid to confront the shadows in their own and others' natures. So that was the writing that we have on Pottermore from Ollivander. And so I think that this does match up with Ollivander pretty well, especially the part where it says they would die a heroic death. Lupin obviously does during the Battle of Hogwarts. He dies fighting against the Dark Lord. And then unicorn hair, we've talked about that quite a bit because a lot of characters have unicorn hair, but they're consistent. So Lupin's obviously very good at Defense Against the Dark Arts. He produces good, consistent magic. They're generally the most difficult to turn to the Dark Arts, which Lupin never does. He never has any doubts. And then they're also prone to melancholy, which we talked a little bit about with Ron, but I think also applies to Lupin. He's pretty moody. He always doubts himself. He's just not a super confident person. So I think that matches with him well also.
Yeah, I really like that one for him. So Remus's house is Gryffindor, which we all know.
His Patronus is a wolf, which we never actually see him produce a Patronus, J.K. Rowling, or a corporeal Patronus. J.K. Rowling made sure that it would never be seen because he is disgusted of his Patronus being a wolf. It is not a werewolf, though. It's very clear. It's a wolf, like a normal animal wolf. His Patronus is not a werewolf.
So his parents are Lyle Lupin, who is a wizard, and Hope Howell, who is a muggle. Howell, it's being spelled H-O-W-E-L-L, but obvious allusion there to Howell, H-O-W-L, like a wolf. So J.K. does have some writings on how his parents met. which I think are pretty cool, so I'll go into that a little bit. Lyle was a world-renowned authority on non-human spiritus apparitions, so that's like boggarts and poltergeists and the like, and he took a trip to a Welsh forest to deal with a boggart that was particularly nasty, and he met his future wife, Hope Howell. She's described as a beautiful muggle girl who worked in an insurance office in Cardiff. So he saw her walking through the forest, and the boggart turned into a big scary man in front of her. And then Lyle hears her scream and gets rid of the boggart for her and walks her home. So when he figures out that he says something originally about it being a boggart, but then when he figures out that she's a muggle, he just kind of plays it off like he got rid of the big scary man. So she thought that he had saved her from danger, and he didn't say anything for like until months later when they had been dating for a while that she wasn't really in any danger when he met her. So they fell in love and got married and had a boggart topper on their wedding cake, which is pretty cute. And then they had Remus after 1 year of marriage.
I love that. I love that story. I think it's so cool that JK has, like, given us that information. Who would have thought that, I don't know, who would have thought of the love story between Remus Lupin's parents, but that's really cool. So his skills listed on his Pottermore profile are that he's exceptionally gifted in defense against the dark arts, which we see because he obviously is a professor of defense against the dark arts in Harry's third year, so he's got to be pretty good at it.
And then his last thing listed on his Pottermore profile is sadly his death date, which was May 2nd, 1998, the day of the Battle of Hogwarts. And JK has written a little bit about Remus's death. She said that Remus Lupin was one of my favorite characters in the entire Potter series, and I made myself cry all over again while writing this entry because I hated killing him. So that's what she wrote at the end of her Pottermore entry on him, where she talks about his parents and then some other things that we'll get to in this episode. And it's interesting because JK has said that she didn't originally plan on killing him, and she didn't decide that until Order of the Phoenix. She was always, like, going back and forth between killing Arthur and killing Lupin. So Arthur lives, so Lupin dies.
Yeah, this might be a little bit of an unpopular opinion, but I am glad that Arthur survived. I won't say I'm glad that Lupin died by any means, because I mean, he's a great character, and he has a beautiful child that he just got to meet before he died, but I think I would have been more devastated if Arthur had died. Sorry. But that's just the truth. And then moving on, we're going to talk about the first time he was mentioned in this series. So I have kind of a long excerpt from Prisoner of Azkaban. "This only had one occupant, a man sitting fast asleep next to the window. Harry, Ron, and Hermione checked on the threshold. The Hogwarts Express was usually reserved for students, and they had never seen an adult there before, except for the witch who pushed a trolley. The stranger was wearing an extremely shabby set of robes, which had been darned in several places. He looked ill and exhausted, though he seemed quite young. His hair, light brown, was flecked with gray. 'Who do you reckon he is?' Ron hissed as they sat down and slid the door shut, taking the seats furthest away from the window. 'Professor R.J. Lupin,' whispered Hermione at once. 'How do you know that?' 'It's on his case,' replied Hermione, pointing at the luggage rack over the man's head, where there was a small battered case held together with a large quantity of neatly knotted string. The name Professor R.J. Lupin was stamped across one corner in peeling letters." So from this first meeting, we learn a little bit about Lupin as a person. So we learn that he is not well off. His robes are a little shaggy. His case or his suitcase is a little battered and it's held together with string. We learn that he's young but has gray hair, so that could come from worrying and stress. And then we learn that he's taking the Hogwarts Express, which no adult they'd ever seen. They've never seen an adult on there before besides the Trolley Witch, which, like, LOL. Cursed child. So, yeah, I think we do learn a little bit about Lupin. We don't learn anything about who he is as a person. And I feel like it's interesting that this is learning that he's kind of poor is never really brought up again. They might describe his robes as shabby throughout the series, but other than that, it's never really talked about. So I think it's interesting that that was kind of the first thing we learn about him.
Yeah, one thing that I like about this little excerpt is where it says that he looked pretty young, even though his hair was gray, because I always forget that, because I'm so saturated with the movies, I always forget how young Remus and Sirius still are, even when Harry is in school, and yeah. Subsequently I forget that James and Lily were, like, 21 when they died. So it just makes it all the more tragic, whereas, like, in the movies, they are portrayed as being closer to, like, their 50s, and in the book, they're actually in their early 30s.
Yeah, I mean, he should be, like, what, like, 33-ish at this point?
Yeah. And then the other thing I was thinking about related to this was just, we don't learn a lot about his personality here. We get, like, the description and everything, but obviously he's sleeping, so we don't learn, like, some key character traits. But then later on, when they're still on the Hogwarts Express, he, like, gives the chocolate to Harry and mm-hmm. everything. And so you do get, like, a pretty good look at who he is as a person before they even get off the train.
Yeah, and then also with this first mention, it goes on to say that Ron goes, oh, I wonder, like, what he's doing here, who he is. And Hermione goes, oh, he's obviously, like, the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. And Ron goes, how the heck do you know that? And Hermione says something like, well, if you just think about it, that's the only vacancy we have. So, like, obviously he's the Defense Against... I just think, like, I cut that out because it would have made it really long. But just a solid Hermione and Ron moment.
Love it. All right, so moving on to the Myers-Briggs analysis of Lupin. So Lupin has been given the INFJ personality type, which is called the Advocate by 16 personalities. So these traits are introverted, intuitive, feeling, and judging. So I'll just, like, forewarn, when I was reading through this personality type, I was getting very excited. I think this is probably, like, one of the best matches I've come across so far for a character and a personality type. I just thought everything really was spot on with a lot of the things we know about Lupin. So, sorry if I get a little bit carried away. All right, so the first thing is that INFJs are a really rare personality type. They make up less than 1% of the population, and they have an inborn sense of idealism and morality, but what sets them apart is the accompanying judging trait, so that's the J. INFJs are not idle dreamers, but people capable of taking concrete steps to realize their goals and make a lasting positive impact. So I really like this description for Lupin. I like that he has a rare personality type because I do think he is pretty unique within the series. There's not a lot of characters that are like him, especially being kind of like a quiet Gryffindor, and he's a little bit of the odd one out in the, like, James, Sirius, Lupin trio. I'm not even going to include Peter because he's irrelevant.
Doesn't count.
And then I think the things about him having this sense of idealism and morality are pretty spot on. And he isn't an idle dreamer, like it says. He doesn't just sit back. He becomes part of the order. He fights and, like, works for what he believes is right. So moving on, INFJs, though they are soft-spoken, they have very strong opinions and will fight tirelessly for an idea that they believe in. So that goes right back to what I was just talking about with the order. They will also act with creativity, imagination, conviction, and sensitivity, not to create an advantage, but to create balance. So I think this is key with his work in the order, like I said, but also the last sentence reflects his approach to teaching. He is sensitive with Harry and Neville particularly, like teaching Harry on the side and speaking to him about his dad a little bit. And then he's also pretty creative with his teaching methods. Not, like, until this point, they had not had a good Defense Against the Dark Arts professor. And in Lupin's class, like, they learn so much. I always think about the Boggart lesson, which might not be super creative, but in comparison to what we have seen in that class, it is for them to actually get to do something. And then I really like the final exam that he gives them at the end of the third year, where they have to work through that kind of, like, obstacle course of the dark arts. The next thing says that friends would all do well to remember that INFJs need time alone to decompress and recharge, and to not become too alarmed when they suddenly withdraw. INFJs take great care of others' feelings, and they expect the favor to be returned. Sometimes that means giving them the space they need for a few days. So this whole thing echoes a lot of Lupin and Tonks' relationship for me. He's always super concerned with how Tonks and subsequently her parents might be feeling about her relationship with him because he is a werewolf. So he's like super hesitant all throughout their relationship at the beginning when they start to really connect and fall for each other. Then when they decide to get married and when Tonks gets pregnant, he has these hesitations during all of those stages where he does feel like a need to withdraw a little bit. And Tonks, I think, understands that. She's obviously like a little confused by it at the beginning, I think, and it ends up like reflecting poorly in her, but then she starts to understand like that this is how he deals with things, which I think is really important. Then the next thing is that INFJs, the passion of their convictions is perfectly capable of carrying them past their breaking point. And if their zeal gets out of hand, they can find themselves exhausted, unhealthy, and stressed. So we always think of Lupin's like constant up and down in health being a symptom of his being a werewolf. But I think it's also this personality trait where he is obviously struggling because he's transforming every month, but he also doesn't really take care of himself, and he's working so hard, whether it be with the Order or at Hogwarts or something, that he does get exhausted and unhealthy pretty quickly. So some strengths of this personality type, which I ended up agreeing with all of these, so I'm just going to list them all, are creative, insightful, inspiring and convincing, decisive, determined, and passionate and altruistic.
I think, like, one that I maybe don't associate with Lupin off the bat is inspiring and convincing. But then if I take a second and think back to him working with Harry and trying to get Harry to be able to perform a Patronus, he is really inspiring and, like, convinces Harry that he's capable of doing it and inspires him to do it. So, yeah, I like all of those for him.
His weaknesses are sensitive, extremely private, perfectionistic, always need to have a cause, and can burn out easily. So I've touched on a few of these already, the burning out easily. He's also very private. I mean, he has to hide the fact that he's a werewolf from most people. And I think he is very sensitive as well. When it comes to romantic relationships, INFJs take the process of finding a partner very seriously. They will take the time necessary to find someone they truly connect with. Once they've found that someone, their relationships will reach a level of depth and sincerity that most people can only dream of.
I mean, I think that's definitely true for Lupin, just because, I mean, it will take time to find someone they truly connect with. I mean, he doesn't find, if we're going off of that, he was around 33 in the third book. He was around 35 in the fifth book. So, I mean, that's getting on the older end to find your life partner, so.
Yeah, and he's definitely very serious with his relationship with Tonks. He doesn't just dive into it. I mean, there's complications because he is a werewolf, so he's not casual in that. Going forward, from the start, it can be a challenge to get to know INFJs as they are very private, even enigmatic. INFJs are very insightful and have a particular knack for seeing beyond others' facades, interpreting intent and compatibility quickly and easily, and weeding out those who don't share the depth of their idealism. So I think that this kind of sounds like Lupin's role in The Marauders. I don't know for sure because Joe won't write it. But he's private at first and doesn't quickly let the other Marauders get close with him. He's reserved because he's trying to hide the fact that he's a werewolf, which is just so much to think that like an 11-year-old was going through that. But also, he's super insightful within the group, I think. And I think he can kind of see beyond James and Sirius's joking around facade.
So, going a little bit into the writings that J.K. Rowling has about Lupin, there's quite a long backstory of how he was bitten and kind of why he was bitten, because he was specifically targeted. So, throughout the series, we learn that Greyback was, in fact, the werewolf who bit him. So, starting at the beginning, during Voldemort's first rise to power, so, like, while Lily and James were in school, Lyle, his dad, was asked to join the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures. So he worked with the ministry dealing with regulation and control of magical creatures, obviously. And so through this job, he ended up meeting Fenrir Greyback, because Greyback had been brought in for questioning because he was suspected in the death of two Muggle children. At this point, there was the werewolf registry, which I believe Umbridge kind of spearheaded.
I think you're right.
Yeah, so obviously just another reason to hate Umbridge, because the werewolf registry masks itself and parades itself as a benefit to werewolves, because if you submit yourself for the registration, you can get, like, ministry aid, all this stuff. But if you submit yourself, then you're basically outing yourself as a werewolf, and nobody really wants to do that. So nobody joined this registry.
That sounds exactly like something Umbridge would do, so. And I think I remember hearing that, so you're definitely right.
Yeah. God. Just like I said, another reason to hate that woman. But so at this point, Greyback was not on the registry because, as I previously mentioned, most werewolves weren't, because they didn't want to out themselves as a werewolf to the greater wizarding community. So throughout his kind of trial or questioning, Greyback had tried to convince them that he was just a Muggle, that he didn't know anything about the wizarding world or magic or wizards and witches or any of it. And most of the questioners were convinced by Greyback, but Lyle, Lupin's father, was not. Lyle wanted Greyback to be held at the ministry until the next full moon, because Lyle had suspected him of being a werewolf. And this was the next full moon would have only been 24 hours later, so he wouldn't have had to hold him for that long. And he basically just wanted to prove that he's a werewolf or he isn't. And then during this, Lyle had said that werewolves were soulless, evil, deserving nothing but death. So he wasn't very kind to werewolves. And the rest of the committee believed Greyback. They didn't side with Lyle, so they made Lyle leave, basically. While the ministry witches and wizards were escorting Greyback out of the ministry to let him go, they were supposed to put a memory charm on him to make him forget the questioning, forget everything, but they never had the chance to, because Greyback and two werewolves who were waiting outside attacked the ministry officials that were leading him out, and they left. They fled. So Greyback didn't end up getting this memory charm put on him, so he had remembered what Lyle had said about werewolves. After this, Greyback told all the other werewolves what Lyle had said, the horrible things that Lyle had said about them as about werewolves, and they decided that they wanted to take revenge. So Greyback entered Ramus, Lyle's son, at night, at the point when Ramus was 5 years old, and attacked him. Lyle ended up being able to save Ramus's life, so Greyback didn't kill Ramus, obviously, because we meet him later and he's not five. So he was able to drive Greyback off, but he was not able to prevent the fact that Ramus was bitten, and he's now becomes a fully fledged werewolf every full moon. It does say that Lyle eventually regretted what he had said about werewolves, because he saw how this condition affect his son, and that his son was still the boy he was before he was bitten all the time, except for once a month when he transformed into a werewolf. So he kind of regretted saying that all werewolves were these awful people, these awful creatures, because he got to see firsthand that when they're not a werewolf, they're just a normal person like everybody else, and they can regret what they do while being a werewolf. And then Lyle didn't end up telling Ramus the circumstances around his attack for a while, because he was kind of embarrassed of how it had happened, and he was afraid that Ramus would blame him and get angry at him. So he did end up telling him, but it wasn't for a while after the original attack. So that's kind of the story of how and why Remus became a werewolf. And it's kind of sad because it really was nothing that he did. He just ended up being the son of this man who had said some really bad things about a werewolf, and he was targeted for it. I mean, it's really sad for Lyle as well as Remus. To do something and have your son be punished has to be like an unthinkable and unimaginable feeling. It's kind of, I don't know. I just think that the whole situation is really sad for both the dad and the son.
Yeah, it's definitely a tragic story that ended up affecting both of their lives. Moving on, after he was bitten, kind of bringing it up to where we meet Remus, his childhood, of course, was hard after he got bitten. The family had to move around a lot to avoid people finding out, and Lyle did all he could to find a cure, but he was unsuccessful, obviously. Remus was subsequently pretty lonely, and he wasn't allowed to play with other kids because they were afraid that he would let slip that he was a werewolf. His parents thought he would never be able to go to school because of this, but one day before Lupin's 11th birthday, Albus Dumbledore showed up at their house, and they, like, weren't going to let him in, and just, like, it, the way J.K.'s writing goes, it says, like, 5 minutes later, he was playing gobstones and eating crumpets by the fireside with the young Remus Lupin, which is honestly the cutest visual ever. Like, two really wholesome characters right there. So then he explained that Albus Dumbledore explained that he would make accommodations for Remus at Hogwarts, and he thought that he should still attend school. When he got to school, he quickly became friends with fellow Gryffindors James Potter and Sirius Black. He was kind to Peter Pettigrew, even though James and Sirius weren't really. So Peter got adopted into their group as well.
Because it's all Lupin's fault.
Yeah, he can't be mean. I mean, what are we going to blame him for that? So pretty quickly, the other Marauders found out where Lupin was going every full moon. He was going to the Shrieking Shack, which were the accommodations that Dumbledore had set up. So the Marauders all became animagi, and they would run around the Hogwarts grounds with him, which is so cute. That's like friendship right there.
Oh, man.
So then he got the nickname Moony, and by the end of his time at Hogwarts, he was a prefect, star student. Everybody loved him.
Side note, I know everybody really wants to know how I'm doing in Hogwarts mystery. So currently I am working on the quest of becoming an animagus myself. The first time the quest came along, I did not complete it, so I'm really hoping I can finish it this time. That was all I had.
Okay, so you have to update us when you
Two more days. I think I can do it. I might have to spend some gems to get more energy, but gotta make sacrifices, man.
What do you think, what's your guess what your animagus would be?
Well, so there's, like, a picture next to, I mean, people probably know this or not, but there's, like, a picture next to the quest, and it's of this, like, eagle bird kind of thing. So I don't know if that's what everybody turns into or if it's different for different people. If you know, hit us up in our email, which we will be giving out at the end of the episode.
Good plug. Okay, so back to Lupin. After he graduated from Hogwarts, him and the other three Marauders all joined the Order of the Phoenix because Voldemort, who had started his rise to power back when the whole thing with Greyback happened, was well on his way to, like, becoming the most powerful wizard. So they worked for the Order for a little bit, and then Lupin was on business for the Order when he found out what happened to James and Lily, and how he thought Sirius was now in Azkaban for killing Peter, but really Sirius was in Azkaban for attempting to kill Peter, but Peter was not dead. Spoiler alert. So basically, James, Lily, Sirius, and Peter, the four people who were the most important to him, are all gone in a matter of hours, and Lupin is instantly alone. So then, we don't know a ton about what happened during those, like, 13 years before he meets Harry on the Hogwarts Express, but we know that he lived in poverty a lot because he was unable to get a job because he's a werewolf and no one would give him a job until Dumbledore brought him to Hogwarts to teach Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Yeah, and I think something that is really important in kind of that whole part of his story is that when the Order of the Phoenix was suspecting a mole that somebody was feeding information to Voldemort, Lupin was the first person that a lot of people thought was the one doing it just because of him being a werewolf, like based on nothing else. And I think it actually is stated somewhere that Sirius even thought it was Lupin. So I think that's just, like, pretty devastating that one of his best friends and probably James, maybe Peter, well, never mind, Peter knew who the mole was. It was freaking him. but, yeah, I think that's pretty sad.
Yeah, I think we find out in the Shrieking Shack when Lupin's like, will you forgive me for thinking you were the one that ratted out James and Lily? And then Sirius is like, will you forgive me for thinking you were the spy? So Sirius thought he was the mole, so that's why Sirius said that Peter should be the secret keeper. Yeah. Which I think is interesting, because really the only thing against Lupin is him being a werewolf, whereas, like, Sirius's family had a lot of ties to Voldemort, so yeah. It almost feels like if you're suspecting people based on, like, who they know, then it should be Sirius, but nope. They were all just still prejudiced against him, even though they'd known him for so long.
Yeah, that's just really sad. Makes you feel for Lupin a little bit. If that's just a portion of kind of the prejudice that he felt throughout his life, it's got to be rough. So the next section is going to be about the Wolfsbane potion. So I decided to dive a little bit into what this potion is and what it does. I could not find anywhere where it listed the ingredients of the potion. All I found was that all of the ingredients are pretty expensive, which is one of the reasons why it's not readily available. So, starting from the beginning, the Wolfsbane potion was invented by Damocles Belby, who we learn in Half-Blood Prince is Marcus Belby's uncle. So this is kind of the only reason that Marcus Belby is invited into the Slug Club, or at least the first couple meetings. I don't know if he ends up making the cut or not, but that's interesting, just like a tie to current day Harry's time Hogwarts. And so this potion does not cure being a werewolf. You are still a werewolf if you take this potion. It just helps manage and ease the symptoms of being one. So it helps you stay aware during your transformation. So normally when you're transformed into a werewolf, you kind of lose your head and you just become this, like, bloodthirsty animal. But through taking the potion, you keep your head and you're able to just sleep the whole time, I think is what one of the descriptions said. The potion is very difficult to brew, and like I mentioned earlier, the ingredients are very expensive, so it's not a readily available potion. So Snape is actually one of the only people who can complete it and do it to a satisfactory job, because I did read that it is very dangerous to get wrong, because there is an ingredient in it, aconite, I think they said, which is very poisonous. So I guess if you handle it wrong or do something wrong in the making of it, it can be poisonous and kill you. So that's rough. And then, so Snape being able to make the potion is actually one of the reasons, or one of the only reasons, that Lupin agrees to come back and teach at Hogwarts, because Dumbledore had promised him a supply of Wolfsbane the entire time that he was at Hogwarts, and Lupin, like, doesn't have access to the Wolfsbane potion normally, so Dumbledore used that to get him to teach at Hogwarts. And so it says that you must drink a goblet full every night for a week leading up to the full moon. And this made me think, is a goblet full like a standard unit of measurement? I feel like goblets can be different sizes. Do they use goblet instead of cup or something? I thought that was interesting. Anyways, like I mentioned earlier, the ingredients are very expensive, making it nigh impossible for werewolves to brew it themselves, as they usually live in poverty due to their difficulty in finding stable careers. So not only is it expensive, but werewolves are normally pretty poor, so it just puts it even further out of reach. Which is kind of interesting, because if you have a potion that is specifically for werewolves, but werewolves don't have access to it, what's the point? It just seems pretty silly.
Right. No one else is going to benefit from this potion besides werewolves.
Yeah. I mean, I get, like, you can't change how expensive ingredients are, but it just seems very silly for the only people that can benefit from it and take it are people who can't afford it. And then one last thing about the Wolfsbane potion is Lupin says it's disgusting, that it's absolutely gross. And it's mentioned that sugar cannot be added to the potion to make it better, because that would render the potion ineffective. So basically, the potion tastes disgusting, is super expensive, and you still have to turn into a werewolf.
All right, so our next section is going to be on lycanthropy as a metaphor for AIDS, which is something that JK has talked a little bit about. So lycanthropy is being a werewolf. So JK has written, Lupin's condition of lycanthropy was a metaphor for those illnesses that carry a stigma, like HIV and AIDS. All kinds of superstitions seem to surround blood-borne conditions, probably due to taboos surrounding blood itself. So I think that's kind of interesting, just that she uses lycanthropy as a metaphor to talk about something in the real world. She has said that she used this to show that the wizarding community is just as prone to prejudice as the muggle community, which another example of this would just be the whole pureblood, half-blood, muggle-born status thing is pretty much just racism, straight up. So I think it's, I just really like how JK uses Harry Potter to talk about real world problems. And like, these are books that are often read by young kids. So it just like introduces all of these ideas and teaches people to be decent.
Yeah. Isn't there that study that's like, kids who grew up reading Harry Potter are like more empathetic or something?
Yeah.
I love that. I think it's so true too.
You may be biased.
So we're going to talk a little bit about Lupin's relationship with Harry, just kind of hitting the highlights. So Lupin ends up being Harry's favorite Defense Against the Dark Arts professor. This comes from a quote in The Goblet of Fire. So, I mean, he still has, what, three other Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers at that to go, but I think it probably stays the same. So throughout The Prisoner of Azkaban, Lupin and Harry have a pretty close and pretty unique relationship. Lupin gives him extra lessons. He teaches him how to produce a Patronus. They just have a really close relationship. It's a little bit more than a student-teacher kind of relationship. And what's also interesting is throughout this year, Harry doesn't even know that Lupin and his father were BFFs. He just is connecting with him based on who he was. Lupin ends up being Harry's kind of last link to his father through the Marauders and through that group of friends at Hogwarts after Sirius dies, which obviously doesn't last too long because then Lupin dies, but I think there's also a couple quotes in Half-Blood Prince where Harry talks about how he doesn't get any mail anymore because Sirius would be the only person who would send him mail, and how, like, Lupin can't send him mail because he's doing his undercover work in the werewolves or underground work with the werewolves, and Harry gets really sad about that. So I think that he really saw Lupin as kind of this, he saw Lupin in the same way he saw Sirius, kind of like a godfather figure, even though Lupin wasn't technically his godfather. I think he saw him pretty on par with that kind of relationship he had with Sirius. And then we learn in The Deathly Hallows that Lupin makes Harry the godfather of his son, which is really cute. And ends up, I mean, being very important. And I think we learn that Teddy ends up getting sent to Tonks' mother, when he's still young. But then we learn in the epilogue that Teddy comes over for dinner at least once a week. He might as well just move in. So, I mean, Harry kind of, I don't think he really feels the burden or gets the burden of being a father quite right out of Deathly Hallows. But, I mean, he's the godfather of a baby and both of his parents are dead. So he's got to feel some responsibility for that kid at quite a young age.
Seems like he might end up being a better godfather to Teddy than he is father to Albus Severus.
Oh, Lord, the shade, the shade. I mean, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think Teddy seems a little bit more similar to James than Albus. And I think James and Teddy were easier for Harry to parent than Albus. He just feels a connection to them, I think, more. But anyway, so there is one point in Harry and Lupin's relationship when things kind of come to a head. And this is obviously in Deathly Hallows when Lupin comes to Grimmauld Place when Harry, Ron, and Hermione are hiding out there, kind of before the real hunt for Horcruxes and all the camping starts. And so Lupin comes and basically says, let me come with you. Let me help you complete your mission for Dumbledore. I don't need to know what it is. I just can be an aid. I can be a resource for you. Let me help you and let me come with you. And then Harry kind of flies off the handle and basically yells at Lupin and says, listen, bud, you got to buck up. You have a wife. You have a child on the way. You need to stop running away from your problems like you had done your whole life and face it head on. And he kind of explodes at Lupin, and then Lupin explodes back at Harry. I think, like, he either pushes Harry or, like, magically pushes Harry over and, like, storms out of the house. And then I think what's really interesting with this relationship is then the next time they see each other, everything's fine. I think the next time they see each other is when Lupin comes and asks Harry to be the godfather of his child.
Right, at Trell Cottage. Yeah, I think you're right.
So I think Lupin knows that Harry was right. He knows that he was in the wrong in this situation. It takes some time, probably, but I think that shows Harry's maturity really well, that Harry was able to recognize and basically have the courage and the maturity to stand up to somebody who he sees as a father figure and tell him what's up.
I think it does show Harry's maturity, what you're saying there. But I also always kind of interpreted this outburst from Harry as a sign of personal things for him. So, like, at this point in time, the only people he trusts are Ron and Hermione. He's stressed out by this task that seems totally impossible. And this is right when everything starts to get really real, because it's after the wedding, so they had those, like, few days or weeks or whatever of bliss at the Burrow where they're, like, preparing for the wedding and everything, and then, like, Voldemort takes over the ministry and, like, okay, things are real. They're, like, cooped up in Grimmauld Place for a while, and I always kind of interpreted it as, like, yes, Lupin needed to hear these things, but the way that Harry does it, where he pushes him away and is pretty harsh about it, I kind of interpret also as him just acting out a little bit, because he maybe would love to accept Lupin's help, but he doesn't feel that he can because Dumbledore told him not to tell anyone, and also he knows that Lupin has these responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I think I see it in a little bit different way. I think, to be honest, I am fully on Harry's side in this. I don't really feel bad for Lupin at all. Like, Harry, I think, delivered this in a very effective way. Yes, it came off as pretty harsh, but I think Lupin really needed that kick in the butt. I think he really needed Harry to get up and yell at him for him to do something. And also, I think maybe this, he has underlying emotional connections with this, because, I mean, Harry was quote-unquote abandoned by his father. Obviously, his father did not choose to abandon him. His father was killed as a baby, and Lupin doing this on purpose, voluntarily, to his own kid, I think hit Harry in the feels as well. But I think that Harry was completely justified in yelling at Lupin, saying some pretty harsh things, because I think Lupin needed to hear it, and I think Lupin would agree with me. So, I don't know. I think that moment is up for a lot of debate by Potter fans. I think a lot of people see it as very out of character for Lupin to fight back at Harry for him to even want to join the hunt for Horcruxes in the first place. I think a lot of people try to forget that that happened with Lupin, and to be honest, I did the first couple rereads, just because it doesn't happen in the movies and we're so saturated with the movies and it seems so out of character. But I think it's very important to remember that this did happen and that Lupin kind of had this moment of weakness. And I'm not saying it's bad. Like, everybody has moments of weakness. I'm not blaming Lupin for doing this, but I think that it's a very interesting relationship dynamic that Harry and Lupin have at this moment.
Yeah, it's also interesting because it comes so near the end of Lupin's life, so it's like one of Harry's last memories with Lupin is this, and then like Lupin showing up at Shell Cottage asking him to be his Teddy's godfather, and then basically after that, the next time they see each other, maybe they see each other briefly, like right before the Battle of Hogwarts starts.
Yeah, I think they do.
So it's kind of sad, but I think he did need to hear it, and it shows that he's not perfect. Okay, so we do our Where Are They Now section in every episode.
I was going to say something really mean.
Yeah, spoiler alert, Lupin is in the ground now.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, spoiler, he's in the grave. That's what he is. Again, RIP, love Lupin, but...
So, just a little recap, like, since towards the end of the series, during the Half-Blood Prince, Lupin and Tonks get together. In between Deathly Hallows and Half-Blood Prince, they get married, which, yay. And then Tonks becomes pregnant, and Lupin is having doubts about their relationship and bringing a child into the world, which we just kind of talked about. He was concerned that that Teddy would end up being a werewolf. But as it ends up, Teddy inherits Tonks' metamorphosis ability and not lycanthropy from Lupin. So he really drew two good straws on that one.
Yeah.
Which I want to know, like, I want to know the genetics of all this.
Yeah.
Dive into that.
Well, something interesting with the genetics of the werewolf, I think one of the reasons why Lupin is so worried is because I think he mentions at one point, people like me don't have kids. So they really don't know if it's even possible to pass it on through genetics. So they really know nothing about it. So Teddy should be studied and find out what's going on.
Yeah, because I think it's probably so rare that a werewolf, like, finds someone that would want to have kids.
Yeah, or even, I think probably, like, it's rare that they live this long. I feel like werewolves, go in, like, when they're a werewolf, I think that they could get killed pretty easily if they're just like attacking things and people, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the beautiful things about Tonks and Lupin's relationship.
Yeah.
And then, so of course, Lupin is killed by Dolohov. How do you say that?
Dolohov? That's how I always said it. I think that's how Jim Dale says it, so.
Okay. He's killed by Dolohov in the Battle of Hogwarts. And then Harry sees him and Tonks lying in the floor in the Great Hall.
Okay, side note, one of the very few things that Deathly Hallows gets right, I love the imagery of you see Tonks and Lupin, like, reaching out for each other while they're alive as Death Eaters are starting to break into the Hogwarts grounds, and then the next time you see them, their hands are trying to touch each other when they're dead on the ground in the Great Hall. And that is just so heartbreaking. I think that Deathly Hallows and Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince all do Tonks a disservice. We really don't see any of her character, barring maybe the first, like, 20 minutes of Order of the Phoenix. After that, she's rarely mentioned. I don't think they show her character very well, even when they do show her at all. So I think that in the movies, that if you just watch the movies, that moment might not be as heartbreaking. But if you've read the books and you kind of know their relationship and you know who Tonks is, that just is absolutely devastating.
Yeah, I agree. We'll get into Tonks at a later date.
Yes, of course. She's one of my favorite characters. I can't wait. And then side note, also about their deaths, I am a firm believer in kind of the purposes for... J.K. Rowling has a purpose for every character she killed. And Lupin and Tonks kind of serve the purpose of creating this new, like, a new generation orphan who was orphaned by the war, kind of to parallel Harry. And I really kind of like that she did that, and I like how she gave Harry kind of the opportunity to be that godfather that he maybe never got with Sirius and with Lupin, you know, so... Again, one of the reasons why I'm not mad about Lupin being killed, and another one is I really am glad it's not Arthur. Side note, I named my car, is named Arthur, after Weasley. Yeah, it's an old man car, it's blue, I figured it was a perfect, Arthur was the perfect name for it. So, like we end every episode, this one we're going to end with a pop quiz, and today's question is, who is your favorite Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher? That Harry has.
All right. I mean, I'm pretty average on this. I have to go with Lupin. I mean, we just spent an hour talking about him or whatever. Yeah. But I just think I really like the way he approaches his teaching. I think he's such a good teacher and, like, adult in for all of the students, especially Neville and Harry. He really cares about his students, and I think that's one of the most important things. And yeah, gotta go with Lupin.
Yeah, and I might be the most biased person ever towards the Goblet of Fire, so I'm gonna have to choose Mad-Eye Moody / Barty Crouch Jr. This isn't a super popular choice. I mean, I obviously like Lupin more than I like Barty Crouch Jr., and I probably like Lupin even more than I like the real Mad-Eye Moody, but the things that Harry learns in the fourth year are just so... like, so important to him becoming who he is. Mad-Eye Moody / Barty Crouch Jr. was the first person to plant in his head the idea that he could become an Auror. And then he obviously takes that dream throughout his last couple years at Hogwarts and into his job. He learns that year how to fight the Imperius Curse, which I think helps him. And... I don't know, I just feel like the stuff that he learned in the fourth year was just so much more applicable to him and his eventual role in the ending of Voldemort than what he learned from Lupin. And again, I just love the fourth book. And I do really like Mad-Eye Moody. I know that it's not Mad-Eye Moody, but he does a pretty damn good impression of Mad-Eye Moody. So, yeah, that's my answer.
Okay, to wrap up with some announcements, you can go subscribe to us on Apple and Google Podcasts to download and listen to our episodes, which are released every other Tuesday. Also, just leave us a review if you like us. Let us know.
Yeah, if you don't like us, don't leave a review.
Yeah, don't do that.
And then you can follow us on social media on Facebook and Instagram as Wizard Studies Podcast. And then, like I mentioned earlier, if you have any suggestions, any comments about our episodes, any suggestions for episodes or pop quiz questions, you can email us at wizardstudiespodcast@gmail.com.
All right. As always, thank you so much for listening. Just do your best. We'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.